And with a look at the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Director Mark Staples. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie. The main news is that yesterday there was an avalanche on Davenport Hill, which is on the ridgeline kind of between Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons on the upper end, and a skier was caught and carried, partially buried but not injured, in an avalanche that broke about 2.5 feet deep, 300 feet vertical, about 125 feet wide. The layering that produced this avalanche exists throughout our mountains, especially on the more northern half of the compass, slopes that face that direction. And conditions have definitely become less sensitive, and we have a moderate danger now. But this avalanche confirms that avalanches are still possible due to this layering. With the storm coming up, we're kind of in a holding pattern, and we'll expect by this weekend for conditions to become a little more stable when we add the weight of that new snow. For now, main thing is there's great riding and skiing on lower angle slopes, ones that are less than 30 degrees, where you don't have to worry about avalanches. There's still good powder on the shaded slopes, and that's the best strategy to avoid avalanches at the moment.
Okay. Mark, thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:11. Well, the Park City School Board met yesterday to discuss master planning, the budget, as well as the next steps in the search for a new superintendent. In the studio with me, I have the president of the board, Andrew Kaplan. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning, Leslie.
So let's just start with the superintendent search. We're moving forward with that?
Yes, that's correct.
And what did you learn yesterday?
Well, we just had a brief, probably 10-minute overview of the timeline process from our search consultant, HYA. They're going to be in town on next Tuesday, the 23rd, having a meeting with the board at 12 noon that's open to the public. During that meeting, we'll really start to flesh out the timeline for interviews, start to organize focus groups in the community and at the schools, and really officially kick off the process, as well as talk about kind of expectations, you know, advertising strategy, recruiting strategy, et cetera.
Yeah. So I ask because you had a room full of the who's who of Park City at yesterday's board meeting, all seemingly with a message or questioning of what's going on in our school district, that our superintendent, who has said more than once publicly she had hoped to have the job for 15 years and feels like she had to resign after just the first five. What we've heard from you is that you will respect the superintendent's decision to resign, so the matter is closed?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the board's concerned, the matter is closed. I mean, the superintendent resigned. She has not asked to rescind her resignation. And, you know, as an elected board, we have a responsibility to make sure that we have a superintendent in the district. And because of the timing, now is the sort of the nationwide recruiting time for superintendents, as well as, you know, senior education jobs. And, you know, we're not going to delay that process any further, which is why we've, you know, we've hired a consultant firm and we're moving forward. And the goal is to, you know, have our community focus groups as soon as possible, complete interviews by the spring, and have someone in the seat by this summer.
You know, and I wasn't there, but I do have notes from our reporter who told me that the TEDx Youth video by Skylar Jackenthal was shared with the school board that talks about kindness and respect for others. And then you heard from a number of the members talk about the role that the school board should play in retaining the superintendent in her position. Your comments seem to refute that the school board is struggling, yet public input, I think, pretty clear that people in the community are very concerned about the turnover of the board and the departure of some key leadership positions in the district. So what does the board do here?
Well, I think we take the advice from the community, right? I think we have to observe and respect the fact that there are you know, community leaders, I've described them as, and people who are very well respected, who have served publicly on municipal councils and in various capacities, who are offering advice to the board and saying, look, we're concerned that there's turnover, we're concerned that there's change, and we want to make sure that the district is moving forward. And so, look, it's our responsibility as a board to listen to constituents, especially ones with, you know, with elected official experience, and continue to try to improve and do the best job that we can. And that's That's been our focus. That continues to be our focus. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, you look at the turnover that, we're having at the senior level, you know, two of the individuals are at retirement. And that's something that we've, you know, that's a part of life. You know, we're very fortunate in our district that we retain employees for a very long time. But sometimes they get to the point where they want to do different things or they're at retirement age. And so we have two there. We have one, unfortunately, our principal at the high school who's leaving for health reasons, which, again, outside of our control. And, you know, the superintendent is also leaving. And that's one that, you know, we're going to have to focus on as a community to replace.
Have you asked the superintendent if she wants to rescind her resignation, given all that you're hearing in the community?
Yes, we have as a board.
And would you accept it if she did? She just hasn't. Is that the case?
She's not rescinded her resignation. And, you know, unfortunately, because of timing, we have to move on. Right. And again, as I've stated here on the radio before, and as I stated in the meeting last night, the board unanimously decided to, you know, renew the superintendent's contract for 2 years in September. So that is the clearest sign of all that we unanimously wanted her to stay. She resigned to us, you know, prior to Christmas, and we've had, you know, many conversations since then. And, you know, the board has decided to hire a consultant and to start that search.
Can we find out, though, what went wrong that brought her to the point that she wanted to offer her resignation, given, again, that she has said publicly several times that this was a job she thought she would retire from?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, you know, what she said to us and what she said publicly, which is I think she got frustrated of kind of the atmosphere in the community, the finger pointing, the public comments, the badgering. And as I've said to you on this program, having been in this role for only a year, I can see how taxing that is and how difficult it is to take criticism publicly in a constant fashion. And she's done it for 5 years, which, you know, is pretty incredible. And she's done it with, you know, with grace and done a great job. I mean, I think, again, I'm not surprised that we had a handful of folks in there supporting her and thankful for her time. She's done a great job. And our schools, if you look at our district, you know, our schools are going from strength to strength, right? We were recognized again this week nationally for having the best district in Utah. And, you know, and a lot of that's happened under, you know, under her watch. So, you know, it's no surprise that folks want her to stay and that the community is concerned about turnover and change, as they should be, right? I mean, that's, you know, change is never, you know, change is always questioned. It's always, you know, we always wonder why it's happening and people are always concerned that we come out on the other side better than we were before. So I certainly can empathize with that and have no issue with the comments.
Sounded like there were more than a handful of people, though, asking you.
I mean, we had four public comments on that. So those four individuals also have written letters to the editor in the Park Record. They've also emailed us. We've also, as board members, met with several of them individually. And so we take it very seriously. It's not something that we're dismissing. But we also have a responsibility to our constituents and to the district to make sure that someone's in that seat. And we need to make sure that there's someone who is 100% committed to the district who's there.
And when you talk about the finger pointing that's happening, is some of that finger pointing, though, happening by board members against the superintendent?
No. I think some of the finger pointing is at the superintendent. Some of the finger pointing is at the board. And again, I think, you know, if you look back at, I'd encourage everyone to watch Skylar's TEDx. I think the point there is for this community to preach kindness and love, not hate. And that's something that you've heard our superintendent talk about as well. And I think we've all kind of recognized, and this is symptomatic of what's happened on the national scale, but people are empowered to point fingers and to be upset and to angrily accuse folks who are in public positions. And unfortunately, that's happened and seeped into our community, which is a shame. But no, we're not. I don't think anyone is happy about this at the district. I don't think anyone is pointing fingers. I think it's now our job to accept it and move on and do the best we can for the community in terms of finding a replacement.
You and I have gone back and forth on this, but again, you heard it from Sally Elliott yesterday saying that the school board is dysfunctional. Again, you say the board is not dysfunctional, but again, we have people saying that.
Yeah.
Perception is everything, as you know.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? We take, I take what you say very seriously. I take what Sally Elliott says very seriously. And we have to look at ourselves as a district. We have to look at ourselves as a board, as individuals, and see how we can change that perception and how we can function better. We're all here to try to do the best thing for kids, whether that's someone who's elected to the school board or someone who's an administrator or a career educator. And part of that is a learning process. And, you know, especially as we have people who are new to the board, we need to continue to learn and improve the way we do things and how we interact with each other as well as the community. So I'd certainly say that we have room to improve, but I think every person in every job has always room to improve. And I certainly wouldn't say that we're operating in a perfect way, but again, I would reiterate that what's happening in the district is positive. What our recognitions show that we have excellent educators, we have great principals, we have great administrators, and you know, we're going to continue to try to keep that bar very high.
Yeah, you had responded, though, after Sally, that the school district criticism is a disservice to the teachers, the students, and the administrators. How?
Well, I think when you come up and you criticize the administration, and some of the comments were that if you do a Google search, and this wasn't from Sally, but this was from someone else who spoke, if you do a Google search, you see that the district is a problem and that there's all kinds of issues and why would anyone want to come here? And I take issue with that. I mean, I think if you do a Google search right now, you're going to see USA Today, you're going to see Business Insider, you're going to see US News and World Report, you're going to see Blue Ribbon Schools, you're going to see our superintendent nationally recognized for her work on opioids. You're going to see a lot of great things. And, you know, and that's coming in a great community. And we have very high expectations. So it's understandable that people are upset and they're concerned about the change. But what I don't want to have happen is that, you know, we only have people pointing out the negatives of what's going on and ignoring the positives. So, you know, I think we all have to look at those comments and take them very, very seriously. But again, we also can't ignore the good that's happening.
So as we search for a new superintendent, then, and as you heard from Terry Shoemaker from the State School Boards Association, we may have a really tough time given some of that negative back and forth that's happened. So do you anticipate having a tough time?
No, we already have some applications that have been coming in from very qualified people. I don't anticipate a tough time. It's, you know, the double-edged sword of the amount of turnover we have coming into the district is that we're going to lose a lot of intellectual capital, and we're working on ways to retain that and try to extend some of our administrators from their retirement. But, you know, the good news is that for a new superintendent to come in and have the opportunity to come into a district that's so highly performing, but also have an opportunity to build their own team is a very attractive proposition. And, you know, we have a number of community members who have been in education. We have a number of people who are very high level in terms of search and management who have already started to volunteer to help us in the process. And I'm not concerned that you know, this community is going to be able to attract someone who's excellent. I think we are very fortunate to live in a wonderful place. Our schools have been run very well, and this is a great job for someone to come into. And it's a great community for someone to move their family to as well.
On another issue, board member Julie Eihausen made a comment about the lack of transparency that you personally didn't disclose your personal friendship with her replacement, newly appointed board member Aaron Grady. Julie had said that she just wanted to state her concern publicly. You didn't respond. The vote back then was 3-2. Do you think you should have noted that friendship before the vote?
Well, I didn't respond because it was a baseless accusation. You know, Aaron is someone who I know because our kids go to school together, and they were actually in the class together. I believe her specific accusation was that my wife and her were very good friends or best friends, which isn't the case. They've known each other. They've both lived in town for 20 plus years, and they've done work together before at the chamber and things like that. But they've never socialized together in a private setting, in group settings, sure. And I would venture to say that I've probably spoken to Aaron more in the last 2 months since she was brought on to selected to replace Julie than my wife has in the past 17 years. So unfortunately, you know, people are able to comment what they want in meetings, and sometimes it's accurate and sometimes it's not. I chose not to respond then. I'll respond to you because it's a fair question and people deserve to know the answer. But I still do not feel like by knowing her through our children going to school, that would have resulted in me recusing myself from voting. It's, you know, being accused of an ethics violation is a very serious accusation. I take that seriously, and it's simply not the case. And I think anyone who knows me, who knows Aaron, knows that, you know, knows what the facts are. And it's a shame that on her exit, she decided to insult me as well as member Grady. But again, there's not much I can do about that.
Did she accuse you of an ethics violation?
Yeah, she did. She said that I should have recused myself from voting because I have a personal relationship with her. And that's simply just not the case.
So when we talk about transparency, though, mm-hmm. hindsight, of course, we know 2020. Mm-hmm. I mean, should you have at least said that our families are familiar? I don't know what you said.
No, I mean, there's very clear rules about that. I mean, if we're related to anyone, if we have personal relationships, you know, family relationships or, you know, professional relationships with people, those are meant to be disclosed. But being an acquaintance of someone in a small town like Park City is not a... is not something that needs to be disclosed. I would venture to say that Julie knows her as well. She's a neighbor of hers, and they've known each other for a very long time, probably longer than I have known Aaron. So, you know, again, I believe in transparency. This is a baseless accusation, and it's a shame that it had to come up in that format on her last meeting. She has served our district well, and I wish her the best. But... you know, again, it's, you know, I guess getting back to your earlier question about dysfunction on the board, you know, when there's comments like that, yeah, I guess you could call that dysfunction. And I'll take responsibility as a board member for those things happening. But, you know, I'm one of five people, and we have, you know, a number of different personalities, and I can't control what people say, right? Whether they're, you know, regardless of what it's about.
Real quick, multiple comments made about the public on the wellness issue of kids at McPullen having recess taken away. It sounds like the principal may be using the recess policy as a way to manage behavior. What's going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion around that. It's actually great timing because we're reviewing their wellness policy. And we went to a community meeting at McPullen last week. Member Butler and I were there. And there were a number of parents concerned with the afternoon recess being taken away. There's in the elementaries, there's two recesses. One of those was taken away for a number of different reasons, some behavioral, some class time, things like that. The community members have come to the board and said, look, you're reviewing wellness policy. We want you to include recess and physical education and activity in that wellness policy. And so that's what we're going to do. Our job is not to get into the weeds with what's happening in individual schools, but we certainly want to work with the administration and take a look at the science and the studies behind the appropriate level of outdoor time for our kids.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you real quick about the budget.
Yeah.
You're still working on a short timeline here to get something finalized, and the administration teams in each of the schools working hard to identify their needs for the coming school years. You discussed staffing. It looks like the draft budget for next year showing 15 FTEs, full-time employees?
Yeah, that's right. Seven of those, I believe, are assistant principals. There's a number of different kind of administrative adds. One of the things that our administration and team are moving towards is MTSS, which is multi-tiered structures of support, which Ben Belknap talked about last time we were in. And that requires a few more people. The model is essentially having administrators pushing knowledge and counseling into the classrooms and helping to train our teachers to do more, as opposed to pulling kids out for intervention. And so a lot of the proposals in the budget were for additional people to help with that. So things like language coordinators, interventionists, curriculum coordinators, people to kind of beef up the admin to work on that process. And that's really, it's almost a philosophical discussion. And that's the one that we're having with administration you know, in our next work session, and we're going to include principals in that as well as the cabinet and the board, and really try to figure out the best way forward and how many spots we have. I mean, we have a space issue, we have budgetary constraints. So there's a lot of different factors to go in there. We want to be as supportive as we can to the administration for their needs, but we also have to be responsible to the taxpayers and make sure that we don't do too much too fast.
Sure. Don't we have assistant principals, though? We do at the high school.
We do at the high school. We have two. We have two at the high school. We have one at Treasure, and we have one at Ecker. The additional would be at the elementaries and potentially as well at the schools where we already have assistant principals. We've been continuing to ask our building administrators to do more and more. And a lot of that is kind of the responsibilities that schools have now, whether it's wellness and various things that didn't exist previously. And they're really strapped. And so this is one of the main asks, is they need more bandwidth at the building level. And that's one of the things that we're all trying to review and figure out a way to make that happen.
Okay. Andrew, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Park City School Board President Andrew Kaplan. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:38. Good morning. Well, although Western Resorts were optimistic to hear that lodging numbers and rates were up from just a month ago, that's changed as many Western resorts have struggled through December with a combination of below average snowfall, as well as how the holidays fell last year, impacting school breaks, causing a dip in both occupancy and revenues. On the phone with a closer look, Tom Foley, he's the vice president of business intelligence for the travel firm Intopia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tom, first explain how your firm works and how it gathers its data. You worked with Destry Metrics, watch a number of different, looking at different resorts from across the country?
That's correct. We collect lodging performance data from lodges in various ski communities across the country. We contract with the destination marketing organization, and through their relationship with the properties, we establish a data relationship. We collect data on a monthly and semi-monthly basis. That looks at occupancy, average daily rate, and a metric that hoteliers use called RevPAR, which is really analogous to revenue.
A month ago, I reported for the month of November, occupancy up more than 7% in resorts and revenues up more than 11% compared to the same time last year. But it sounds like that's all changed. What do the numbers say for December?
Well, the numbers for December are a little bit different. And the reason being, of course, that we've got changes in snowfall. There were a couple things that took place in December that were a little bit out of our control as an industry. And one of them was that there was a school break that happened and usually happens prior to Christmas for the week prior to. That did not materialize this year as a result of Christmas falling on a Monday. So school actually didn't come out until the Saturday. So one of the challenges with the month of December was actually filling in that week before Christmas. Very difficult to do when you don't have the ability to get off school and families aren't traveling. Excuse me. But with the lack of snowfall, we did see a decline start to emerge in occupancy rates, not only for the month of December, which was down 4%, but the season shifted to being down 1% year over year when compared to winter 2016-17 as of the same time. One of the things that we also noted was that there was a slight decline in rates, but rate continues to be very strong across Western resorts, up 5%, and the result of that is that revenues are actually gaining because that rate gain is offsetting the slight decline in occupancy. But our peak months of December, January, and February, they're looking troubled, and we're looking for some snowfall to help turn that around on a dime.
Right. So let's look ahead then through April. It looks pretty bleak at this point, huh?
Well, I think from a booking point of view, bleak is going to depend upon how you're really measuring and what metric you choose to look at. From an occupancy point of view, things are sitting, they're negative, certainly. January is down 1%. February is down similarly, but just slightly. And March is down 3% year over year. So the peak months are struggling, and that is a high volume number. So it can be problematic. But again, we've got strong rates. The consumer to the skiing industry is a very loyal consumer. They're typically performing higher on consumer confidence than the 122 that consumer confidence is at nationally right now. And so we're looking at gains of 9, 7, and 9% across the industry right now for January, February, and March, respectively. So if you're looking at occupancy levels, you're right. That represents skiers and people coming to town and spending money, and that is down, but moderately at this point. But if you're looking at revenue and whether or not people are actually making their grade and what lodging taxes are being returned to the community, we're actually up 8, 7, and 5%. The problem is whether or not that rate gain is sustainable if we continue in a snow drought situation. And that, of course, only time will tell.
Right. And that was what I was going to ask. I mean, can we justify these higher rates given what we've got on the ground?
Sure. And that's where the challenge comes in. Of course, in a consumer-based economy, anything's justifiable if the consumer is willing to pay it. The question begins to become whether or not we're actually pricing ourselves into trouble. And if we start to lose occupancy as a result of rate and not just snow, there are, after all, a lot of reasons for people to come to a mountain destination during the winter, not just to buy a lift ticket and go ski. There's a lot of other stuff to do. And historically, we've seen retail tax sales go up in low snow years. But the lodging rate is going to keep people away if it's up 8-9% year over year, when you've got earnings in the greater economy still sitting at only about a 2.5% gain while the rest of the economy takes off and the cost of travel is higher.
And looking at those in-month bookings for December, we saw the arrivals down almost 0.25%. So we're attributing that to, again, that funny school break and a lack of snow?
Yes, it's going to be a little bit of both. Typically, we do see that the Christmas period from the week before Christmas through to the new year and carrying into January is very strong growth. It does extremely well when snow is strong. But the school break period is a large contributor. Losing that week before Christmas is just no way to fill it in. Add to that challenges with snow, and although people are still coming to enjoy a Christmas in the mountains, their incentive with the ski is missing.
And here in Park City, of course, our lodging rates, my guess, we'll have to look at those numbers locally, but when you look at those in-month bookings for December, January was down 12%. My guess here in Park City, since we've got the Sundance Film Festival, it doesn't matter if it snows or not. But looking at February, down almost 14%, March as well. Bookings, though, are rebounding in April and May. Is that just optimism for some late spring storms?
Well, I think that's part of it, and that's also, of course, the destination travel going ahead, traveler going ahead and booking. But when we look at these long lead numbers, we should also keep in mind that those numbers are artificially inflated. It's a mathematical thing that happens when you're comparing numbers of low magnitude, and the further out we're looking, the lower the magnitude. So that's it in part. Also, we've got an Easter break in April that's shifting from the 16th last year to the 1st of April this year. Technically, during the ski season, assuming there's enough snow for operations to continue. So that's helping fill in the beginning of April and certainly a large contributor there. May, it's the beginning of the summer months. It starts to really note the end of the ski season. Typically, operations are done by then. And what you would do is look at your local calendar and see what events might be driving things in May that far out.
Sure, sure. So what's going to get us through this dry winter? Good advertising,
well,
I guess.
I think the destination marketing organizations are deploying the tool sets that they've got. They learned a lot between 2008 and 2012 about how to deal with consumers when there are challenging events. Back then, it was the economy. Right now, we've got an economy that statistically, at least, is roaring along. But we've got a snow challenge. We've learned about how to deal with rates, how to entice consumers to come. And good messaging does a good job. Ultimately, snow is what we look for. We are talking about winter resorts, and we're looking for that big bang so that there's a good powder day out there. It can turn things on a dime. In the meantime, the economy is going along well as long as it continues to do so. I think that snow towns and ski towns are going to do okay. It's the mountain operations that I think can be challenged, and you know they've gotten pretty smart about how to deal with these things. So we look to snow. It's the bottom line.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, do you folks also track cancellations, or do people even back out once they've laid a deposit down?
People do back out, and we do track cancellations to some degree, but not as formally. We haven't seen as many cancellations taking place as might be expected. What we do see when there's no backyard snow, in other words, snow in an urban area that might drive visitor to the mountain, is that there's a lack of short lead bookings. So the drive destinations hurt more than the long lead further destinations that might be more reliant on flight and people who are less concerned about snow.
And are we seeing a different story back east where there is lots of snow, maybe too much snow?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and that's it. Too much snow is actually a real thing. It's, you know, if it's snowing on Thursday and Friday and you can't get the road clear and you're a drive destination, that's actually a problem. But the east is booming. in the Northeast, and they are very much drive markets, so they don't have long lead reservations the way the Western resorts do from that pure destination travel. They rely on people driving up from Boston and New York and Philadelphia and so forth. But they are booming. The conditions are fantastic. We actually have our head office in Stowe, Vermont, and the staff are having a great time this season.
Okay. I'm going to leave it at that. Tom, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Tom Foley, the Vice President of Business Intelligence for the firm Intopia. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. One of the opportunities at the Sundance Film Festival is the new Frontier lineup, an experience where film, art, and multimedia technology all come together in a program space. This year, New Frontier will be at a brand new location at the newly reconstructed Ray Theater, the former location for Sports Authority. On the phone to explain this year's program, longtime curator of the event, Shari Freelo. Good morning, Shari.
Good morning.
So begin just by telling us how you would sum up this year's New Frontier program.
Well, you definitely, you know, touched on one of the big changes. In two new locations, actually, is at the Ray, New Frontier at the Ray, and also at the Kimball Arts Center. I would say this is probably the biggest edition of New Frontier that we've ever launched. It's at the Ray, there are cutting-edge VR works. There are works around augmented reality and some really interesting works around artificial intelligence. You'll find also, you know, that kind of lineup at the Kimball Art Center as well, some of the larger scale works over at Kimball, and a really remarkable piece that really kind of blends theater and virtual reality in one experience that's truly remarkable. It's called Hero by Navid and Bessie Kansari. I don't want to say too much about it, but it's an experiential piece where you have to really kind of make a choice for yourself whether you're going to be a hero and save someone.
Right. So we've got the Ray, which is going to be ticketed events, and the Kimball is just kind of the people that just come in and see what you've got. Is that how it's going to work? Or
that's right. Yeah. So we have so the New Frontier at the Ray and the Box at the Ray, which is where we'll be showing our mobile VR lineup. Those venues are ticketed. The New Frontier at Kimball, if you have a credential, you can come in for free and first come, first serve. That's also true for the VR bar at Music Cafe.
Okay. So it's kind of nice, I guess, to have some a permanent home here, huh? You've moved around so much.
It sure is. We're really excited. You know, the producer, Jamie McMurray, is just really just walking around with bells on, building up a storm underneath the Ray. It's beautiful, and we're so excited to have a venue that is solid and something that we can count on for the next couple of years.
Sure. Now, New Frontier, it's I don't know. I think it's hard to describe, but it's not only film, it's exhibitions, it's installations, as you mentioned, VR. Let's talk about the films. Those are shown on a screen where?
Yeah, so Frontier, the New Frontier has always been also a lineup of films and performances. You will find them in the lineup, or the you'll find them in the lineup of films. This year we've got four films, there's two films and two performances. We've got Sam Green, who's coming back to do a really remarkable presentation with the Kronos Quartet and the Egyptian. And this is a one-day-only thing with back-to-back screenings on Monday. And then Corey McAbee is back with Deep Astronomy and the Romantic Sciences. This is a kind of a master class, really hilarious and incredibly insightful show about space and the cosmos and what it means to us. We've got Jonathan Luff, who comes from Austria, who's made a film called Star that is really, it's a really great movie for film buffs because it's all of the film throughout time and how they have visualized space throughout the entire history of cinema. And of course, Organ Player by Narcissister, the performance artist, is a very interesting film. It's kind of a hybrid performance and film, which really is ends up being a very sweet and moving documentary about the relationship between the artist and her mother.
All right. And then the installations that you have, those, again, some of them will be at the Kimball, the others downstairs at the Ray?
That's right, yes.
Okay. And how have those been broken up? Just a little bit of each at each location?
Yeah. It's the show is spread over a course of two locations. They're not really broken up in terms of genre or subject matter. You can find, if you're able to get to the Kimball and not to the Ray, you'll find a similar kind of spectrum of selection. Although, at the Kimball, because of the space, we were able to put some of the larger scale works. But for instance, at the Kimball, you can go see VRI, which is a social VR work where five people at a time go in. But over at the Ray, you can participate in Chorus, which six people participate at the same time. Frankenstein AI is something at the Kimball that is probably the piece that can handle the most people at a time. It's eight people, and you go in together to interact with an AI that is also informed by Mary Shelley's seminal text. It's the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein. And together you create this AI and watch it come alive. There's actually a performance of the AI on Monday night at the Box.
All right. What are some of the others that you just wanted to highlight in terms of what you'd think people would find pretty compelling?
Well, this is always a question I can hardly ever answer, because these are 24 works that were chosen from hundreds and hundreds out all over the world, and every single piece was belabored, and it's just really kind of a remarkable show. To kind of round out what the social VR lineup is, there's Zicker by Gabo Aurora, where you go in four at a time to participate in a Sufi ritual. It's beautiful and energetic. And I would say Awavana is another piece we're really excited about to have Lynette Walworth back to the festival. She won an Emmy for her VR piece called Collisions, and she's back with this piece that she has just shot from the Amazon, bringing a message from a shaman there for us here for the audience here at the Sundance Film Festival. But I would say, if you could get to the lineup at the Box, this is something new that we're doing. We've created a 40-seat swivel chair VR cinema for the mobile VR work. So there are going to be so many more people to be able to see this lineup, and it is really, really tremendous. I mean, we've got the Isle of Dogs, which is a VR that has a collaboration between Felix and Paul and the Isle of Dogs production team from the new movie from Wes Anderson. We've got Masters of the Sun that was created by Will I Am, and On My Way, created by Young Jake. There's a lot of there's just a lot of music, a lot of energy, really fantastic VR called Dinner Party that came through the labs. That's about an interracial couple in the 60s that were abducted by aliens. It was based on a true story. It's an amazing experience. And a number of works that have come from Asia this year. It's something that we noted from the submissions this year, that works from Taiwan, from China, and from Korea in the lineup.
Okay. Well, every year you put together an amazing exhibit. I would really encourage people to stop by and spend some time at, again, either the Kimball there or at the Box there at the Ray. Shari, again, thanks for your time this morning, and look forward to seeing what you've got.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Shari Freelo, again, the longtime curator of the New Frontier program at Sundance Film Festival. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.